Marilyn Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2, for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 10, delivered on September 19th.
Today, ethics. And a quick look at the markets before we get going. Strong day or ugly day? Yeah, it's up enough to get our attention. As you can see, it's not a spectacular day, although if you have a good portfolio, it seems to be surprisingly good. And as you can see, after a quick bull pop at the beginning, at the opening bell, the bears tried their funny business, but then there was this just roaring upward, and then a little drop there. No volume spike with it. It was more of a quick sell-off, and then the bulls and the bears have been pushing back and forth all day long. Right now, as we come toward the lunch, the bulls are in a good mood, so they're doing a rally before the brown bags come out. We'll see how the rest of the day goes. But again, though, notice that ridiculously low volume. For a whole day, you would have about 3.5 billion shares trading on the S&P 500 stocks. So far, about half the day is over, and we've got about half a billion. So you've got that really odd thing going on. You're seeing, of course, ups and downs of a market, as you always do, but that's on very low volume, comparatively speaking. So it's kind of creepy. It's eerie when you see this kind of quiet on the streets. A lot of investors, the heavies, are laying back. They're just watching to see what happens next. And that's always kind of a disturbing thing. Now, the subject today, I cover ethics. Now, this lecture has three main parts to it. And the third part, which is about agency, is something that you should be taught in several courses in finance and accounting. And it is not covered, especially the most important part of it. So I've put together a PowerPoint presentation which will open for you to go over at your leisure. It's on the agency dilemma, which is what this is all about. And by all means, have a look at that agency PowerPoint. As I've told you before, I'm not a PowerPoint professor. I don't show PowerPoints in class unless something absolutely disastrous has happened to my voice. So you can look at that, though, to catch some of this. Otherwise, take good notes, because you are responsible for this as well as the special topic of the Tuesday lecture. And you'll probably have a quiz next week. It'll be a surprise quiz, so please be surprised. On the topic of ethics, we're supposed to teach ethics in our classes here at ISU. We are required almost to do so by the state of Illinois. The state of Illinois' legislators have determined that all state employees must take even an ethics training course every year. And we are supposed to teach you about ethics, knowing as we do the ethical standard that the state of Illinois' politicians keep. What is it now? Two of our former governors are in prison, and a number of the state legislators are some of the most corrupt people in the United States. Illinois has the reputation of being the most corrupt state in the nation. And yet they tell me that I should teach you about ethics and that I have to show how ethical I am each and every year by taking a training course and some little exams on it. So with that as your background, I'm not going to do it. Oh, here's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to tell you all the laws on ethics and then say, don't break this law. Here's another law. Don't break that law. Law does not define ethical action. And ethics is our weak, scaredy-cat term for morality. So if you hear me use a harsher term, a politically incorrect term like morality instead of ethics, well, bite me. I want to start with some ethical dilemmas. You see, we are one of the shock fronts of ethical challenge in the business world. Finance, as a matter of fact, has been described as the most corrupt of all fields in business. That was by Forbes, I believe it was, which sort of scares you when an ultra-conservative business rag like Forbes talks about finance being corrupt. That's sort of like Satan telling you that you're corrupt. Gee, that really makes me feel good, but it's true. And if you took a higher level course from me, I would take you through some of the jaw-dropping corruption that just happens in my discipline. But corruption isn't just about finance. Corruption can happen anywhere in the world of business, as it can in our personal lives too. But let me show you how difficult the challenge is. I want you to imagine, and I'm actually telling you a true story, but I'm not going to use the names of the people, not right away anyway. I want you to imagine that there is a situation and you are a currency trader and you have figured out that something is going to happen and you could take advantage of it. Or you could help the government that was going to be the victim of this kind of disaster. And you have this choice. If you help that government, you'll make maybe a 10, 15, 20 million. If you take the action against the government's interests, you will become a multi-billionaire. $2 billion you can make if you say four words to your assistant. The four words are, go for the jugular. Now, if you do that, you will make $2 billion. In today's money, that would be more like about $5, $6 billion. $5 billion, maybe. Or you could say, stop. Call the responsible authorities in the government. Let's get a meeting together. Let's stop this. Now, if you make that $2 billion, the rest of your life is going to be amazing. You will be considered a genius by the people in your field, in currency trading, in finance. You will be able to give money hand over fist to charities. You will go to schools and the children will sing your praises. You will never be sick because you will be able to buy treatments and medicines that are unavailable to hardly anyone else on earth. You could actually have a girlfriend. You will never want for anything again as long as you live. And all you have to say are those four words. Go for the jugular. Or you could do it the other way. Contact the government. Let's get a meeting together. Let's work and fix this. You'd only make a couple tens of millions if you did that. Now, understand that I actually don't care which way you choose, but I want to know, which would you do? Would you say go for the jugular or call the Treasury?
$2 billion? Yeah.
It does. I mean, do you know that you could actually swim in that much money? Seriously, you could just put it in and, yeah. What would you say? Don't stop because this is a split-second decision, as are a lot of things in finance. I can guarantee you, I'm seeing it right now with my trading strategies. I can't make, well, let me think about it. Oh, shit. Too late. You can't do that. What do you say?
I
Don't say feel, just tell me. Feelings aren't it. Not what the government has to say. You're going to fix the government's problem. So you say go for the jugular or call the treasury. What are you saying?
Go for the jugular.
Damn, woman. You said that fast. What would you say?
Go for the jugular.
Okay.
Jugular.
Good. What would you say, ma'am? Yeah.
Oh, I'm
home. Okay. Now let me explain what happens. If you go for the jugular, you will be wealthy beyond your wildest dreams. I mean, seriously, you will become, at that time, probably the wealthiest person on earth. The economy of the country will drop into a massive recession if you do this. People will lose their jobs. People will die of diseases and hunger. The entire world of that country will fall apart and never completely recover. There will even be whispers about the return of the king. That's King Cholera. It is that serious. People will kill themselves because they can no longer find a job. But you will be worth $2 billion, and you will be the praises of you will be sung far and wide. Even the people who wrote the story of what happened and why it happened will be quieted. They will be suppressed. They will be called conspiracy theorists and laughed at and mocked. No one serious will ever tell the story. I did. And my one of the reasons my website was attacked. Only the craziest will be allowed to talk about it because they're crazy anyway. So who will believe this story when they talk about all these other weird things and stupid things? This is the story of George Soros and the Bank of England. Here's what's going on. I'm not going to go into it in too much detail because it does get a little bit heavy on the currency trading thing. But essentially, back in the 1980s, now you guys know that there's a pan-European currency called the euro right now, right? Okay, there was an attempt at a sort of version of this back in the late 1980s. It was called the exchange rate mechanism. The ERM. Now, you don't have to worry about, don't write this out. I'm just going to give you a little quick background. Now, the ERM was an agreement among countries in Europe and the United Kingdom that what they would do is they would hold their currencies in a lockstep sort of way. They wouldn't be perfectly pegged to each other, but they'd float within a band. So that if any currency in this ERM got too weak, they would all come in and defend it and boost it back up into the middle of the band. So in other words, there was this band of currency exchange rates. They could go up and down and up and down, but it never went too far so that any given currency against the other currencies would not get out of hand. That way, they would have decent import-export trade balances with each other. They could act as a united front in trade with the rest of the world. It was okay. It was a decent thing. Well, there was a problem because this was in 1993. Now, here you have Germany. And over here, you had the United Kingdom in the exchange rate mechanism. Now, understand that interest rates are what drives currency value. Interest rates are the price of a currency. So, in other words, if the US interest rates go down, our currency goes down in value. If interest rates in the United States go up, our currency goes up in value against other currencies. So, everything was okay. You know, there was a little bit of a recession going on in the United Kingdom, and there was some turbulence, a little bit of economic pause in Europe as well. So there was some defense of the currency, the UK's currency. But then something terrible and wonderful happened. The Berlin Wall fell. The Soviet Union collapsed. the evil empire of the Soviet Socialist Republic just died. And all those countries were set free. Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, Uzbekistan, Czechoslovakia. It's now the Czech Republic and Slovakia. And East Germany, that had been divided from West Germany since the Berlin Wall went up after World War II. East Germany was suddenly open. West Germany, where all the money was, all the power was, said, we're bringing you home. East Germany, if you had been seen the Soviet bloc as it was, during the time of the communists being in Russia, running everything as puppet governments, I mean, it was a mess. The roads were shot. The sewers were bad. Everything was awful unless you had the money or cigarettes, as we did when we went over there, to get what you wanted. But so when East Germany, the wall came down, well, West Germany said, we're going to fix you. You are our country. And so they started pouring billions of dollars into East Germany. Well, that cost a huge thing. That was a huge thing. Germany started borrowing money to do the job. And if you're going to borrow lots and lots of money, that means that interest rates in Germany started going upward. Seriously. They were borrowing money hand over fist, pouring it into the infrastructure of East Germany to get that country modernized. Well, German interest rates were going up, so relatively speaking, that caused the German currency, which at the time was the Deutschmark, to skyrocket against the other currencies. UK, the pound sterling, was in terrible, it was in not great shape anyway, because they were in a going toward a recession, and they were trying to lower their interest rates to try to stimulate their economy. So here you have the UK, interest rates going down, Germany, interest rates going through the roof, and so the pound sterling started to drop against the Deutschmark. In the ERM band, it was dropping down flat to the bottom, and no one was helping. The Bundesbank wasn't in any position to be able to help the British. And the British said, well, we're in the ERM. We promised that we would keep it within our currency, within the band. And so what did the United Kingdom start doing? It started buying its own currency on the open currency markets to boost its value. How did it buy it? With its gold. It just started buying its currency with the gold reserves to try to keep it from dropping through the band, which would have been a violation of the ERM. The British, being British, said, well, we agreed to this, so we'll do it. And it was getting so serious, the pound sterling wanted to be down here, and they kept supporting it and supporting it. And unfortunately, everyone knew this is going to be a disaster. Sooner or later, you're going to run out of things to sell to keep your currency up, Britain. Enter George Soros and his traders. What they did was they went to the Bank of England and they borrowed pound sterling. A lot. They borrowed it. And what did they do with that money that they borrowed? They went over here and they bought Deutschmarks. Why? Because they knew that when UK finally gave up, this would collapse, the pound sterling would collapse, and so they would be able to use, and that would cause the Deutschmark to skyrocket, and so they could pay off these loans to the Bank of England at pennies on the dollar, which of course, that would mean that the UK's Bank of England, their central bank, would simply have had book on that much money, but when it gets it back, it's worth a tenth of that. The bank buckled. The morning that the UK announced, we've just abandoned the ERM, the currency just boom, like that. The pound sterling just dropped through the floor, and then the Deutschmark, those traders traded in. The Deutschmark then was just insanely worth an insane amount of money against the pound sterling. So they just cashed in a few Deutschmarks and paid off in pennies what they had borrowed from the Bank of England. That was where the assistant came into Soros' office and said, they're about to do it. What do we do? Now, Soros could have gone to the Bank of England and said, okay, we owe you this much, and it's worth so much less than that now. What do you want us to do? Can we work this through so that we can figure out a way to take that $150 million and not pay it off as what it is now, worth so little? We can figure out some way to keep the balance sheet of the Bank of England from becoming essentially a blood red thing. Or he could just simply say, go for the jugular and do the swap on the currency and then pay off the loan, and the Bank of England would just collapse right there. And when the assistant said, what do you want me to do? Soros said, without blinking an eye, go for the jugular. Hence, he is worth $2 billion. And he is so loved by us. He's a big fan of liberal left, and they love him dearly. Conspiracy theorists talk all the time about Soros controls the world and all of that when they're not talking about the Freemasons doing it or something. But anyway, that was the story. He chose that method. Now here, interestingly enough, the exchequer of the currency at the Bank of, in London quickly said, well, can't we prosecute him for what he did? He's wrecked our bank. And that was when they found out, sort of laughably, that there really isn't such a thing as international law. He could do whatever the hell, Soros could do whatever the hell he wanted. He hadn't done anything that was against international law. He had simply done what business people do. Go for the jugular. Profit maximize. Now, here's where I take this to the larger picture. And unfortunately, you will forgive me because I must take you into the world of philosophy for just a couple of minutes here. And leaning on my concentration in philosophy many years ago. Right versus wrong behavior. Now, in our politically correct times, we would call this ethical and unethical. And over here, we have legal and illegal. These are the two different separate dimensions of action you will face as business people. And of course in your personal lives, but I don't care about your personal lives unless you try to crash on my couch some night because your life is crap. But right versus wrong. Okay, now, there are actions that are right and legal. In business, we do things that are ethical and they are legal to do those things that are ethical. That's the easy one. That's the easy one. But then there are these actions that are right but illegal to do. That's where you end up going to prison for doing what you should have done. The young man who was going out into the deserts to leave water for the migrants coming up from Central America, and he was arrested and tried. He got a hung jury. What he did was illegal, but it was right to do that. Then you have legal but wrong actions. What can we do, but it is wrong to do it? We're allowed to do this, but it is not right, but it is just not right. And then we have the illegal and the wrong, which are sometimes even there, it's debatable. How wrong is it? If the law says it's wrong, a lot of people say, well, if it's wrong, it's wrong. That's a simplistic sense. Sometimes you have to ask yourself, well, it's wrong, it's illegal, but is it actually wrong to do this? If you provide Well, I'm not going to get into that too much because I get too many complaints about describing some of the situations where wrong is a questionable thing. But anyway. Now, what do we do in a world that has this matrix? What do we do? There are actually two different approaches to it. There is one that was actually laid out hundreds of years ago. It was laid out by a philosopher named Immanuel Kant. He was very hardcore. He was rigid. He said, people after me think this way. It was called the categorical imperative. Now, when you first hear it, it sounds like the golden rule, but it is not. The categorical imperative directs us, do what you would expect others to do at their best. Always do what you would expect others to do at their best. You see, that's the important part about the categorical imperative. Excuse me. The categorical imperative says, and it sounds like do unto others as you would have them do unto you. No, that's not what it's saying. It's saying do what you would expect others to do at all times. Not just to you, but to anyone or to anything. If you don't want other people to hurt animals, then you should never do it. Never do it yourself. There's no ifs, ands, ors, and buts. There's no situation. Just always go with the categorical. Now, on the other side, there are a couple of versions of situational ethics. I will focus on one of those, utilitarianism. This was laid out by John Stuart Mill in the 1800s. His idea was, and then there was another version of it, of this, that was laid out by Bellamy. The Mill's version is kind of rigid. It works like this. Always do what is in the best interest of the most people. Always do what is in the best interest of the most. Essentially, think about it this way. Greatest good for the greatest number. Now, Bellamy would have said, oh, no, no, no. Nah. You have to be more flexible. I'm not going to go into it in detail. Stay tuned if I do another philosophy course, philosophy of business course someday. But Bellamy says you can't make it quite that easy. You can't say the greatest good for the greatest number every time. And yet, this is... Sometimes we are in the categorical imperative in our laws, but sometimes in our business actions, we are doing pretty much the greatest good for the greatest number. Now, I bring you to the second challenge, and I'm going to do this one. Who haven't I picked on for a while? I'm backing off. Okay, madam, accounting major, you were doing the numbers for a medical research and development company. And you've gone through all the different things and you found, okay, our last trial on this drug shows that it actually has an efficacy rate. It cures a mortal childhood cancer in 990 cases out of every 1,000. It cures the disease. These kids suffer from a kind of illness that would cause them to die in about 5 to 7 years. This drug ends it. It's over. But somewhere in you, you think, wait a minute, what happened to those other 10 kids? Oh, somewhere in the paperwork you find It killed them almost immediately, the drug did. Now, tomorrow morning, I'm the CEO of the company, and I'm going to do a press conference. Our lead study has established that this is an incredible drug, and it's going to save all of these kids. My God. And the FDA is saying, yeah, we're going to approve that right away. Unbelievable. Wow. Hot damn. What are you going to do? You going to keep your pie hole shut? Or are you going to say it kills 10 of every 1,000 kids? It kills them. They could have lived 5 to 7 more years, and it kills them right away. What are you going to do? Don't say feel. Please don't say feel. We're in business. We don't have feelings.
I would still disclose it.
You would disclose it?
I would disclose it, but I wouldn't say that I...
You would, you're going to either disclose it or...
But I would disclose it.
Huh? Oh, it won't make it to the market. If you do that, stock price is going to go through the floor. Wall Street boys are just going to have a cow. And that's not a bull. That's a bear. Down as it goes. Remember how I went down beyond with the A1 steak sauce?
We don't disclose it.
We don't?
No.
What would you do, sir?
I would disclose it.
You would disclose it. Destroy the company? What's going to happen to your career? Let me show you how a toilet flushes. You push this lever. You're going to destroy your career. No one's going to hire you again because you're a rat. This is the reality of it, my good friends, and I will show you case after case where whistleblowers ended up hiding in hotels for years. They lost their kids thanks to some of our big banks that blew them away after they blew the whistle on their corruption. What are you going to do, ma'am? You're going to disclose it. You'll lose your career. They'll shoot your dog. You'll end up working at Denny's. And you'll have to change your makeup and hair because even Denny's doesn't want you anymore because you tattle on people. What are you going to do, sir? You would.
Yeah.
You do understand that you're at the start of your life. You get to my point and you look back and you say, damn, I wish I hadn't been a rat. What are you going to do? I am so disappointed in you people. It's only 10 kids. And who cares about 10 kids when you save 990? Unless one of those kids is yours. And then suddenly it changes its texture. You understand that it is not easy to make the decisions in a business environment. There is that greater good, but almost never are you going to make decisions that help everybody. They are going to hurt people in some cases. So, and a lot of times, it's not even this whole greatest good or maximize shareholder value. Think about a company like McCormick's, which makes spices. You've seen their red and white labels. Well, they decided that they were going to cut the amount of pepper, black pepper in their can from 8 ounces to 6 ounces. It says so right at the bottom, but they kept the same size can. Their competitor has a can that looks very similar. It has 8 ounces in it. So McCormick's quietly reduced how much it has in its can, and the other company is getting creamed because it's offering more, and people don't think it is more. They will go with the McCormick's brand because it has a name that's recognizable. Is that ethical on the part of McCormick's to do that? Oh, hell no. But is it legal? Probably. Now, the other company has taken them to the Federal Trade Commission on an unfair trade practices complaint. But guess where that's going to go? Probably nowhere. And the stories just go on and on and on about the behavior that, well, people like the pepper. Well, people certainly appreciate those donations from George Soros to charities, to schools, to the Democratic Party. Well, that's fine, but people were hurt in that process. And that's the dilemma that we face in the business world, is that ethics is easy to talk about, but it is a bitch in practice sometimes, especially when your own career is on the line, and if you blow the whistle, you're going to be taken out and shot. Companies don't appreciate it. You don't understand their position. We got a company right here in this area. It's a big employer, provides a lot of internships. I won't tell you what it is. They produce incredible machinery. Machinery that does wonderful things, builds buildings, creates wonderful architecture, places for architecture to arise, digs up old things and so we can replace them with new stuff. I mean, you would recognize the name in a heartbeat. They do great things for the world. But they also sell their massive, massive equipment to countries that kill the people in their occupied territories, drive through and plow up centuries-old fields of trees that were the family's lifeblood over the generations. They will knock down houses. They've even driven over people who stood in their way to protest that country does. There are videos that are still out there. YouTube tries to get rid of all the naughty stuff, the horrors of the world, but you can still find them, driving right over a protester with one of these massive machines. So is that a company you want to work for? Well, you probably would. They're a great company, as long as you can keep your nose above the smell of the blood on the land. That's the problem we face. We've got to eat. We've got to take care of ourselves. We've got to maximize shareholder value. And yet, that is going to require that we take the John Stuart Mill's approach and say the greatest good for the greatest number. Yeah, some people are going to die, but hey. You know, there were artillery shells we fired, and I know damn well they didn't hit anywhere near where they were supposed to, especially when you saw the damage in the towns and villages afterwards. You know those were your shells that dropped on that house, and there isn't much left of the people inside. Now, let me take you on what seems like a very different track here. This has to do with agency. Now, I got to do some terminology. I told you this earlier in the course. I've mentioned it a couple of times. In business, we have to use our terminology much more tightly and carefully than people in normal life do. It's like the difference, the seller of a bond and the buyer of a bond. The seller is the borrower and the buyer is the lender. In this case, I'm going to bring up three terms just so that you have these in your portfolio. It actually helps you sometimes even in your personal lives. The difference between an agent, a broker, and a dealer. An agent represents the seller. An agent represents the seller. A broker represents the buyer. A dealer represents himself or herself. So if you go to an insurance agent for your car insurance, we're here for you. No, they're not. They represent the insurance company. That's an insurance agent represents insurance companies, usually one, but maybe more. Okay? A broker, like you go, I'm going to talk to my stockbroker, call him on the phone. That one represents you as the buyer of it, of the stock. Now, if you go to a real estate agent, I should like to buy a house. Well, you've got to appreciate that real estate agent represents the seller of the house, not you. They will try to tell you, oh, no, it really doesn't work that way. Don't let them kid you. Keep sharp on your definitions. Now, a dealer represents his own book or her own book. So a car dealer actually buys inventory for the purpose of selling it at a profit for his or her own dealership. So in other words, on the floor of the stock exchange, on some, you will have, like Amex, you will have dealers They are actually licensed to go to the floor and represent themselves with a portfolio of different stocks that they buy and sell for their own account. And then they pay a fee and commissions to the trading, to the exchange. But that kind of a layout is not unusual. So keep in mind that when I use the word agent in a broad sense, and I'm going to use it much more narrowly in what I'm about to go through here, this is kind of an important thing to know. If you are, for example, I want to buy a house. Well, let me look in the MLS listing. Well, what you should do is find a real estate broker, a broker who will represent you, the buyer, in a transaction. And again, real estate people are going to tell you, well, I could be either an agent or a broker. It's okay. No, find the real deal. So, for example, interestingly enough, back to insurance, we as normal people would go to insurance agents. However, here at the school, we have a magnificent risk management and insurance program. The Katie School is ranked as one of the top three in the nation, and it's recognized all over the world. If you want a job, go into risk management and insurance. It's awesome. But we focus on commercial insurance, not that stuff like, you know, homeowners and car and renters insurance. They are brokers. When big, huge corporations need insurance, they don't go to insurance companies, to insurance agents. They go to insurance brokers. The brokers represent them and go to the insurance companies. So you could have a very large corporation that has a multitude of different risks. A broker will step into the picture and say, okay, we've got to find out where all these risks are, and then we're going to go to the different insurance companies that cover these different kinds of risks and put together a package for you that covers all of your different risk exposures. And when that broker goes to those insurance agents, those insurance companies, I should say, he or she is representing that that company, that big multinational company, or that big, huge local company. That's how it works in that world. So in that kind of a context, that person is going to be representing that company, and he's going to play the different insurance companies off against each other. Okay, I've got this risk exposure. Can you cover it? Yes. Can you cover it? Yes. Okay. Well, you give me your bid, you give me yours, and we'll find the lowest one. He's representing the company, his client. And then if some other broker is trying to get in there, what your job as the broker is, you're trying to lock the markets. Okay, if you give me a bid and you give me a bid, you're not going to talk to anyone else, right? You lock the markets up. So if another broker goes in there to try to get the business, that broker is locked out. And then you say, okay, you say that you're going to give me the low bid. I need a broker of record letter. In other words, we're locked in, aren't we? You cannot, under any circumstances, talk to anyone else about this. That's how it's done. It's actually a very cool world, and you make a lot of money in it. And if you're interested, let me ask me, and I'll take you upstairs. As some of you already know, I will haul you in and get you started in that program. Okay, get that off the board now. I'm going to take you on a little journey here. Sir, I've seen you drive. You drive like a blind trout. These nice long country roads, there you are one day, smooth road out into the shining horizon, and there's this speed limit sign, 55 miles per hour. And you just, yeah, right? You push that pedal down. It's a smooth road, nothing for miles in front of you. You bought an American car. But anyway, you're fine. Okay. You hear behind you a voice say, warp 6. And you're driving so fast, you begin to see the stars streaming by you on the sides. And someone in the engine room is speaking in a Scottish accent. "Hi, Captain, the warp engines can't take any more of this." Okay. While you're driving, you see way up the road, on one of those drive-ins to a field, there's a car up there. Ah, some poor son of a bitch broken down. You get closer and closer. And then you realize, OMG, that's a sheriff's deputy car. What are you going to do? Just keep driving like a blind trout at 85,000 miles per second? You're going to slow down, aren't you? Monitoring. Monitoring is the first part of effective enforcement. Monitoring. That is the first of two steps. Now, you're driving toward that, and you're getting closer and closer, and you say, oh, God, he's standing outside of the car, and he's got probably got one of those radar guns, and he's already caught me. And then you realize, wait, he's stooped over. Oh, he's changing the tire on his car. So what do you do then? Oh, yeah, you did put that pedal to the metal. Ah, officer, how you doing? Doesn't do any good to monitor if there can't be enforcement. These are the two pillars of effective control, both monitoring and enforcing. If you monitor but you can't enforce, you have nothing. If you can enforce but you're not monitoring, you've got nothing. So both of these have to be there in an effective relationship that is business in business or in your own life for that matter. Now here's the problem. It boils down to this, and this will impact you, guarantee you, in your personal lives and in your business lives. It is called the agency dilemma. It is barely mentioned in your book, this term agency. And they just touch on the agency problem, but they don't define it. It's this simple. Now, but also, by the way, here the word person is in the legal sense. It is not necessarily an individual. A person can be a group. It can be a group bound under some kind of covenant, under a contract or an agreement. So when I say person here, it does not necessarily mean an individual, but it could. The agency dilemma. And again, I have a PowerPoint posted. Get some notes here and then fill them in with a PowerPoint presentation and this podcast. When one person, the agent, is responsible for maximizing the welfare of another, and this one is called the principal, that's AL, the agent has incentive to maximize its own welfare. Instead, and this is always, always the case, this is called an agency relationship. There's an agent and there's a principal. The agent is the one who maximizes the welfare of the other, the principal. And the agency dilemma lays it out starkly. There is always an incentive by the agent to benefit himself or herself. Always. Instead of the welfare of the principal. Start with a couple of simple examples. The board of directors of a corporation, are they an agent or a principal, and who's the other party? Of whom?
The company.
No, absolutely not.
The board of directors.
You're right. The board of directors is the agent. is. Notice that it's not they are. It is the agents of what did you say? Of the shareholders. Their job is to maximize the shareholders' welfare. In this case, profit. That is their only job. No, they are not there to maximize the welfare of the workers, not directly, not to maximize the wonderfulness of Mother Gaia Earth, not directly. There is one and only one principle, and that is the shareholders. This is the same, the executive management. Their job is to maximize the welfare of the shareholders. All up and down, the shareholders are the principle, and everyone in that company is the agent as a body and to some extent as individuals. Okay, now it gets a little bit trickier from here. Let's try this one. A parent and a child. Ma'am, who's the agent and who is the principal in a parent-child relationship?
The parent's the agent.
Exactly. The parent is the agent. By the definition, the one who's charged with maximizing the welfare of another is the agent. The one whose welfare is to be maximized is the principal. So in this case, a child is the principal in the relationship. A doctor and his patient. You go to the doctor. Are you the agent or are you the principal? Yes, the doctor is your agent. His or her job is to maximize your welfare, your health. Here's a difficult one. Sir, in a marriage, I caution you, who is the agent and who is the principal? Freezes up like a cat who's been quartered by a lion. Okay. Who's the agent? Who's the principal?
Both?
You can't be both. You have to be...
No, I mean each one is an agent to the other.
No, not the other. Yes? They are both the agents of the marriage. The marriage is the principal. Remember I told you that a person doesn't have to be an individual. In this case... The marriage is simply a contract, but you are both charged with maximizing the welfare of that contract. You get the idea? This is where we are shaping your thinking to be higher than that of people who don't need to know this kind of stuff. However, sir, you are now married, and you are in a happy marriage. Your job is to maximize the welfare of this marriage, and your wife is on a business trip, and you get a phone call. Ring, 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 hello. Hi, this is your old friends at the sorority down at ISU. We're about to have a twerkathon. We'd like you to be the judge. What do you do? Oh, bro. You have not been married long enough. Okay. Do you understand, though? This is the agency dilemma. He has an incentive. Don't tell me you don't have an incentive to say, well, yeah, I mean, I was a soldier. I swore a duty. I was to maximize the welfare of something when I swore my oath. What was the principle in that regard? Does anyone know? It's actually, no, it isn't the stupid flag, for God's sake. Do you know what it was? It was the Constitution. I am sworn to uphold. See, the Constitution can't protect itself. It needs the agents of war, the agents of law, the agents of productive society to do it. In my case, I am an agent, but the question would be, who's the principal? Do you think I listen to Dietz? Oh, I shouldn't say that. He's okay. I mean, better than that last guy. Wow, that was awful. If any of you remember, we had, ooh, that was different. Okay, now, interestingly enough, broadly speaking, I am the agent of civilization. I'm moving civilization from the past to the future by telling you how to be prepared for the future from our past actions. And you can think of all kinds of agency relationships. They're all over the place. But the problem is that no matter how hard you try, as a principal, and know this, it is the job of the principal to monitor and enforce. You assume the agent is going to try to help himself or herself. It is the principal's job to monitor and enforce effectively. That's just the reality of it. Know this, interestingly enough. I'll give you a couple of examples. Now, this falls under what we call, in legal terminology, you can use the term respondeat superior. The superior responder. That would be the principal. The agent's actions are the agent's actions. But it is this, and so in other words, that means that flows, the principal has what we call vicarious liability. Vicarious liability. Were you taught this term, vicarious liability? It means that you can't say, well, don't blame me, blame him. No, he was the agent. You're the principal. There are so many examples of this. When I used to teach business law, one of my favorites was at a bar in West Virginia. There's an issue right there. I said West Virginia, so you know it's going to be strange. At this bar, there were a lot of people who went to this bar because the bartender that was there almost every night, he was magnificent as a knife thrower. I mean, real serious knives. And he could throw them and hit things clear across the room. I mean, people would come from miles around to buy drinks there and just to see him do these tricks. One night, some old crusty geezer, real tough old bastard, walks right in front of a knife that this guy's throwing. The guy looks at it, and it goes right into his eye. Now, being a crusty old son of a bitch, he just quietly turned right around, and then he turned back and grabbed someone's beer and took a snort of it, and then he drove himself to the emergency room at the local hospital. There, he walks in, and the lady who was at the front desk, she's not looking at him. She says, fill out this paperwork right here. And he finally barks at her and he says, lady, ask me if this hurts. She looked up and she went to a happy place right there. This knife, 6-inch knife, is sticking out of his eye. And so we didn't approve that guy doing this knife throwing, so you can't hold the owners of the bar liable. Oh, yes, you can. They were responsible for his behavior. The fact that they did not monitor and enforce appropriately is all that matters. They are the respondeat superior, the owners of the bar. Principals carry that weight. There is only one time, one situation, one circumstance where they don't. And I will get to that as the last point of this lecture. It is the critical part of teaching you about ethics. Before that, though, we need a way to break down. You see, in business, we need to liquidate cost. In other words, don't tell me there's a problem. Tell me a dollar amount. Tell me its cost. Don't tell me you have a great idea. Tell me how much we're going to make. In other words, we want liquidation. We want you to tell us in money terms, whatever it is. And so in terms of the agency dilemma, we have to say, okay, what damage is done by the agent doing what's right for himself or herself instead of for the principals? So that's where we get to the agency costs. And there are five of them. Almost every one of you is going to be a manager or an owner. Guarantee you. That's why you're here in business and not in fine arts college. So you know, recognize these. The first one is perquisites, otherwise known as perks. Benefits taken by virtue of position. Benefits taken by virtue of position. Benefits taken by virtue of position. This is the chief executive officer who has a desk that looks like the landing zone of an aircraft carrier. The leather seat on his, the high back chair, while the other employees sit in their sad little chairs that hurt. They are stealing money from the shareholders. It's now been more than quite a few years ago. I was at a dinner here in town, and there was one of these executives said, you know, we got a position for a comptroller open. You don't have to make that lousy salary as a professor. We'd pay you very well to be the comptroller. I said, you don't want me that way. Because, you see, you take private jets to all these meetings. Well, we have to. No, Greyhound goes to every state I know of. Well, you have these five-star meals. McDonald's serves. So does Denny's. Denny's, 24. You don't need these extremely expensive meals. Oh, well, and the five-star hotels, why? There are motels. I can tell you motels in every city. Now, you might have to dust off the bed or maybe wash the covers, but you do not need to do what you're doing. You're stealing shareholders' money. That is an agency cost. Those are the... Two, shirking. Avoiding your duties. Avoiding your duties. Shirking. This can be as simple as taking 15 minutes to smoke a cigarette during your break. One of my favorites in this regard. There was a manager at this one company where I consulted, and he was bragging, every night I go home with a clean desk. Every night. Well, you know what he does? He moves all the work on his desk to the subordinates, plops it on their desk after they leave, and then he trots home to have a good night. That's shirking his responsibilities. Going from cubicle to cubicle, talking to people, you're shirking your duties. Direct theft. Just stealing. Stealing. It's done incredibly often. Now, that doesn't mean, well, we've got to stop all this theft. I've seen some innovative ways. There was one of my, many years ago, I did a consulting gig for a small slaughterhouse. It was supposed to be kosher. Slaughterhouse in New York. And they had a problem. On the meat cutting floors, they'd have all the employees and in these side places. They were bleeding meat all the time. The jokes were, guys would come to work scrawny and they'd leave with big muscles under their shirts. Women would come to work and they'd leave pregnant because they were hiding a roast. It was just ridiculous. And so they had a plan when I was there. They were talking about spending the money for all of these cameras to monitor, set up policy, firing immediately if you're caught, you know, cameras in the parking lots. And this one young junior executive, a son of one of the senior vice presidents, and I both said, do you know how much this is going to cost? It's not just the camera system, which is going to be insanely expensive. You see it right there. You're going to have people watching that 24/7, or at least reviewing every camera's angle for all the hours that people are there. And then when you fire people, how are you going to prove that they did it? If the camera didn't catch them actually hiding it, you're going to stop them in the parking lot. Oh, there's a lawsuit right there on your hands. The young man who I was mentioned before came up with this great idea. He said, why don't we have a free meat Friday? Every Friday, you can take home 5 pounds of meat. Every Friday. Just roast, steaks, burger, whatever you want. Take it home. It's good. You're all good with it. Interestingly enough, as time went on, they implemented the policy, and the theft went down to zero, virtually. Essentially, they turned an agency cost into just an employment cost. And it made it a lot less than it had been before, because then they could measure and control how much the cost was pulling. Direct theft is a massive problem. As a manager, you probably will run into it. It's just amazing all the innovative ways that employees will steal. You will probably try to steal yourself. What's a couple of paper clips, man? You know, God, get over it. The next one, 4, is lying. Lie. Sir, have you ever lied?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Now, I have. I mean, look at my Tinder account. 28 years old? Yeah, right. Oh, it worked.
Yeah.
No. Okay. Have you ever lied?
Yeah.
We all lie. You've lied. No, you couldn't. No, not you.
Lied, yeah.
Yeah, you lie. Oh, I guess that means you do lie. Okay. Okay, the thing is, lying is a part of our lives. No one is going to stop us from lying. Even if we are under a bullet is pointed to our heads, we'll lie. One of the things that we've found out again after all these years is that torture will not stop lying, will not create stop lying. People will admit to things that they didn't do under torture just to stop the torture. So the thing that was trying to get them to stop lying actually makes them lie. We found that out over and over through history, and we're doing it again down there at Guantanamo. Gitmo is a place where we torture the hell out of human beings to get them to give us information, and what we do is we get lies. And then they finally fall apart and they turned into basically vegetables after they've been tortured enough. Lying is part of life, and you will have employees lie to you. You know, there have been semesters when I had there was one semester when I had a student's grandmother die twice. Twice. I mean, that old hag, she came back from the grave? Gee, silly. I'm home today with a heart attack. At your age?
Yeah.
Turned out he actually did. I felt so bad. Okay, here's one. Have you ever worked with someone who was too stupid to live? I mean, when you say you're as dumb as a box of rocks, you are disrespecting those rocks, man. No, seriously, incompetence is all through business life. It's an agency cost. Think about it this way. Madam, you disappointed me when you said you lied, so I'm going to come back to you and I'm going to say, you were hired. What's your major? Finance, right?
No, marketing.
My God.
I know.
Okay. Somehow you got a job in a major corporation.
Yeah.
Whoa. Okay, so you did really well in your first position, entry level. So we're promoting you. You do really good again. Oh, okay, so we keep promoting you. But you begin to realize this is getting harder for me. And this last promotion, you know very well, I mean, this is as far as you can go, as far as your ability, your talents. But then one day, in the company's offices, the music that's playing over the speakers suddenly changes. Ba 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 ba. And this black robed figure comes walking down the hall. walks right up to your desk.
I have heard great things about you. I want you to be the new vice president of marketing. Together we can rule the galaxy. Join me or die.
Now, you know you can't do this. And you don't want Darth Vader. So what are you going to do? Say no or yes.
Oh, no. I have the keys to the executive bathrooms.
Let's do it.
Okay. This is a principle of business. You will rise to your level of incompetence, and then you'll stop there. She's going to rise to the place where she can't do the job. You see this in coaching. You see this in executive management all the time. It's just how it happens. Incompetence. So now that one agency relationship where it's not the principal's job. There are times when a principal cannot monitor and enforce. A child can't. When you're under a surgical anesthetic, you can't monitor the doctor's performance. We call these relationships fiduciary. It is characterized as the highest duty implied by law. This is higher than any duty possible. And it goes back thousands and thousands of years. You see it in the covenants of the knights, even in the Middle Ages. The blood of the covenant is stronger than the water of the womb. It is characterized by three features. If you have to be an agent in a fiduciary relationship, then you must carry it out with trust, loyalty, and fidelity. Fidelity is faithfulness. A fiduciary relationship is extremely honored. Don't violate it. And also, don't think that you can do more than one fiduciary relationship. That's all I have for you.